This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow is producing, and we start with one of the fine writers in America, Ken Wells, a journalist and novelist who grew up in Cajun country, graduate of Terrebonne High School and Nicholls State University. Started his career when he was 19 years old at the Houma Courier. Earned an English degree in 1971 from Nicholls, and then he served as student body president in his senior year and was named the Courier's managing editor in 1973, a position he held until 1975. He went off to the University of Missouri, one of the great journalism schools in the world, got his master's, and has worked in many places, including the Wall Street Journal. And with the Journal, he was the page one editor at one point. We'll talk with him about his varied career, but oh, by the way, Ken Wells, who now lives in Chicago, has penned six novels, and the latest is Swamped. And good morning to you, Ken. It's been too long. It's nice to hear your voice once again.
Jim, you're very kind to have me on your lovely show. I'm thrilled.
Well, it's our honor, and you are an amazing writer, and Louisiana produces, for its size, with 4.7 million people, I think, more than its fair share of musicians, writers, people in the artistic world, and there's something about Cajun country, I think, that inspires people. What are your thoughts about how your past has been a catalyst for your success all these years later?
Well, you know, I grew up in Bahia Black. You know, my mom spoke Cajun French and cooked a mean gumbo, and my dad was an outlander from Arkansas who became basically an alligator hunter. And alligator Annie Miller, you know, was one of our nearest neighbors, and she was the founding mother of the Louisiana swamp tour industry. So, you know, I had a fairly eventful childhood, and then, you know, I ended up, you know, going and living all over the world. I was in South Florida for a while, in San Francisco for a while, in London for several years, and Manhattan for a few years. And the farther I got from the bayous, the more interesting it became to me. And I was sitting in the Journal's office one day in Manhattan looking around and realized that I was the only guy on the staff who had ever, you know, skinned a possum or sucked a crawfish head. And, you know, so surely I could make something of that. You know, we have such an interesting and vibrant and old culture there. And, you know, it's just not boilerplate America, you know, and the farther I got, you know, I think the clearer I saw it. And so it became sort of my canvas. If I were an artist, I'd be painting it, but instead I'm a writer, so I write about it.
There you go. I like that. Your canvas. And it appears that no matter how far people get away from Louisiana, and Ernest Gaines is a great example of that, they tend to write about their time here and the people and the culture. And that brings us to your latest work. You've had, as I stated, a varied career. On the latest, you have collaborated with a close relative. Tell us more.
Well, yeah, you know, I always wanted to, well, first of all, I always think that if I just keep typing, good things might happen, you know. And I always wanted to write a survival story. And, of course, thinking about a survival story in Louisiana, where would you put it? Well, of course, in you know, the Greater Atchafalaya Swamp, or the Atchafalaya Basin, as most of the locals call it. You know, it's 1.4 million acres. It's a scenic rival to the Florida Everglades. They have a national park. We have this thing that most people outside of Louisiana have really not heard of. And as a kid, I spent a lot of time there with my dad and brothers, mostly fishing, you know, sockeye and, you know, doing a little exploring. And I remember one day we were out in a boat and there was a thump on, you know, on the motor or something. We'd hit something. And this 5-foot-long paddlefish, like this prehistoric monster, just kind of comes up and rolls up onto the surface. We didn't hurt it. It swam off. But it just, you know, it was like a riveting moment where, you know, where else in the world would you see that? So when I decided to write this survival novel, I had to put it in the Greater Atchafalaya Swamp, which is a place I know fairly well. And of course, the other dynamic is it's really about two teenagers. And the first one is Jack Landry, a kid, you know, who is a precocious swamp rat because he was tutored by his trapper grandpa, Pawpaw Landry, you know, sort of grew up in the swamp. And he gets a job on a high-end swamp tour company in a New York City philanthropist and his engaging teenage daughter fly in for the tour. And unfortunately, the plane goes down in the swamp. And of course, young Jack, the swamp savant, and the young woman from Upper East Side of Manhattan are the only two survivors. And they have to find their way out of the swamp. And the amazing thing about the Atchafalaya, it's a wondrous place to go and see giant alligators and magnificent bird life, but you wouldn't want to be stuck out there, with no food, no water, no way to tell anybody that you're lost. So that was kind of the premise of the story.
All right. Well, Ken says he honed his storytelling skills as a journalist at the Wall Street Journal. He gravitated to what is loosely called feature writing. And during his days at the Journal, when the paper had a generous travel budget and appetite for offbeat stories, they published on page one as sweeteners for a business-centric readership. You went to places, as you note, like Kodiak Island, Alaska. You traveled the world, and you brought your Cajun past with you, and you did some amazing work. And I think it no doubt is revealed in the work you're doing now.
Well, yeah, the Journal was certainly a catalyst for me. It tended to be this really sort of first class operation, full of just really smart people, and they treated you like you're smart. And again, we had a generous travel budget, so you could kind of go anywhere if you could pitch a story that the editors liked. Money was not the object of getting you there, nor was time. So that it was just a great deal of fun to be able to sort of do those kinds of stories. And, when you publish a bunch of stories on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, it gives you a lot of confidence that you can do other kinds of writing, truly, in a way that gives you a lot of confidence that you can do other kinds of writing. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I began to think I should be writing novels as well. So.
And my good friend Alex Martin, who was editor of the Reveille and hired me as his sports editor many years ago, he's now one of the main editors at the Wall Street Journal. And Ken Wells, you covered many stories that go way beyond the environment or the culture or the people or the music. A listener noting this, and it goes back to a conversation I had with you 20 years ago. 21 years on February 1st will mark the day that Daniel Pearl died in the most horrific of ways, and you were very close to him, weren't you?
Oh yeah, Danny. We all still miss him. I still have a link to his foundation website on my website, so that he will never be forgotten in terms of what I can do. And I'm still in touch with Ashra Namani, the former Journal reporter who was, in Pakistan with him when he was kidnapped. And we talk about Danny often. He was just such a good guy, a great journalist, and. Yeah, you'd go to the bar with Danny and have a few beers, and he told great stories. And he was just a great, great colleague. And what happened to him was just such an enormous tragedy and horror that we still aren't over it.
38 years old, and as horrible as it sounds, death is death. But when you kill somebody the way he was killed, he was decapitated. That takes away any dignity at all. It is the most inhumane way to kill somebody.
Oh, it's horrible. And, I still have sort of nightmares about that. I traveled widely in Africa. I was in South Africa when Mandela was coming out of prison. I was in some dangerous spots. And, what happened to Danny, I wouldn't have worried about decapitation, but there were plenty of places where you could get shot and where you could get mugged and you could be beaten up just because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, we all, as journalists who did that kind of work, sort of whistled past the graveyard. But for this to have happened to Danny the way it did was just unfathomable.
Well, your transition as a writer, you say, the epiphany came one day as you sat in the Manhattan offices of the Wall Street Journal. And you were serving as editor and writer on the Page One staff, and you looked around at your esteemed colleagues, more than a few graduated from Ivy League schools, and what went through your mind, Ken?
Well, yeah, again, surely I was the only person there who had skinned a nutria, and you know, and caught, caught live alligators in the swamp at night while frog hunting with my dad. So I thought I could, you know, make something of that. And, I grew up, I'm old enough to, seen TV Westerns, Roy Rogers and the Lone Rangers. And so, the latest book really is, I think, what I call a gumbo Western. They're dangerous critters and they're chase scenes. And, it's kind of a romp in the swamp. So even though it deals with a serious issue like survival, I think there's a great deal about it that, make it sort of fun reading. So, that part of, and I'm a I'm a Cajun at heart, and Cajuns are storytellers at heart. And part of storytelling is to inform, but it's also to entertain. And so as part of my projects with my book, I always try to throw in some entertainment value.
The book is Swamped from Ken Wells, written with his niece Hillary Wells. We'll talk a bit more with this fine gentleman, and then we'll hear from Luke Mixon after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with the exceptional writer Ken Wells, formerly of the Wall Street Journal and now a writer of six novels, including one with Hillary Wells. It's called Swamped. It's the latest work from him, and it's about his life and times in South Louisiana with a great storyline to go with it. And Ken, you note that South Louisiana, which was settled 300 years ago, remains one of the last vestiges of Southern Europe. How do you see the correlation for a man who's traveled the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, when, as I was growing up on Bayou Black, Louisiana, my mom spoke Cajun French. This was the 50s and early 60s, and she had plenty of people to speak with. I mean, there's no other place in America where, conversational French was heard, down at the grocery stop down the road, or if you went to barter for a crawfish or milk from the cow, the dairy farmer down the block, down the bayou, my mom, bartered in French. So, and then you look at our food and, our culture and our music. I mean, it's just, there's no place like it. There's absolutely no place like it, any place that I've ever been. So that's why it remains my canvas. And in terms of like collaborating with my niece, the idea of this book originally was to write, a book for boys who don't read as easily and often as girls do. And, as a writer, you always have to have a couple of long-suffering friends who are really, really willing to read your early ugly drafts. And so I sent it around to these long-suffering friends, and the feedback was good. Oh, we love the plot and we love the place, but we're not sure about these kids, do they really talk like contemporary kids? The book is set sort of post-Katrina. As it turns out, I'm somewhat removed from the teenage cohort. It's been a while since I've been a teenager. So I sent it to my niece, Hillary, who's 30-something, much closer to the cohort. She's a comedy writer, lived out in L.A. for a few years, making her living that way, and has moved back to Louisiana. And I sent it to her, and I said, help me out here. Read this, and especially the dialogue between the kids. And anyway, so that's what happened. We ended up upgrading the fashions and sort of upgrading the dialogue. And of course, Hillary, because she writes comedy, thought that there were just more places where we could take advantage of sort of snappy dialogue, so that even in these dire circumstances, these kids, if they trade information, also sort of poke general fun at each other. So I think it turns out to be, fun in a way that it wasn't before. So so that's how that collaboration happened.
It's about Jack, Kane Landry, and Olivia, and it's called Swamped. And I love your observation that most men are boys at heart. Most boys have a ridiculously recurring fantasy to be stranded someplace, a desert island, a deep canyon, a remote forest, a swamp, pick your venue, with a winsome young woman with whom you're able to save with your cunning and bravery. So Ken Wells, congrats. Let's keep talking. I miss you, and I love your observations on life, and it's great that it began not so far from here. And for those who would like to pick up a copy of Swamped, what's the best way to do it?
It's available everywhere. You can go on Amazon or BarnesandNobles.com, and if your local bookstore does not have it, ask them to get it, and they can get it for you.
Thank you, my friend.
Jim, you're so kind. Thank you. Appreciate
it. Good talking with you, Ken. See you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. And in studio is my favorite pilot, Luke Mixon, the man from Delta who not so long ago was running for the United States Senate, and mentioned that regardless of your politics, if you're a Democrat and you plug these nuggets into a computer, it would say perfect candidate. And you know, I'm looking at the guy. He's a nice looking fellow, born in Bunkie, served in the U.S. Navy from 2001 to 2016. He was a decorated warfighter, earned a bachelor's degree from the U.S. Naval Academy in 2001, worked as a commercial airline pilot after being a fighter pilot in the Navy, and he still is a pilot. And I saw him recently on a flight from Atlanta to Baton Rouge. And he is closely affiliated, people in Baton Rouge know, since he has now moved here, with his church, Our Lady of Mercy. So, fine family guy, and he ended up finishing third. What the heck happened, Luke Mixon?
Well, thanks for having me here, Jim. That's a great question. You know, certainly a disappointing finish. It was always a long shot campaign. When I entered the race, I knew that we needed a couple breaks along the way in order to make a runoff. We never got those breaks, and it didn't work out. But I was still, the finish was more disappointing and unexpected than I thought. I thought we would do better, and just didn't work out.
Well, you did. You had a disadvantage in fundraising for sure with the incumbent John Kennedy. And at the end, no doubt he viewed you as a more formidable foe than Gary Chambers, and he started attacking you. And some of the stuff, I thought, is this the same Luke Mixon I've been talking to the last year? He said you were in favor of defunding the police. Where did that come from?
You know, I don't know. I got a lot of those mailers in my house as well, and they certainly went on the attack. And I viewed that as a compliment, and I really was almost excited about it, that they were attacking me. But ultimately, I believe those attacks, they didn't do them because they don't work. And I believe they did work, and certainly hurt our campaign there in the very end. But look, I'm proud of the race we ran. And although we had a disappointing finish, I'm proud of the effort we made. And there was a little bit of guilt there toward the end because I had a lot of very supportive folks behind me, and a lot of people donated their money to our cause. And I felt a little guilty for disappointing them, but they've all reached out to me and you know, expressed their gratitude and their pride in the campaign we ran.
Do you think you'll run again?
You know, that's a tough question. I would say yes. I would say yes. And only because I believe, and I made this clear, I believe that the Donald Trump far right wing MAGA movement is harmful to our nation. It is harmful to our democracy. It is harmful to our American values. And if there is a candidate in Louisiana that stands for those things, I will stand up to that, because we live in this fragile republic, this fragile democracy that we must fight for it all the time. And if I feel that I'm in a position to fight for that, I will.
Luke Mixon is with us, and your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. And he got in the game, and I commend anybody who gets in the arena. And if they do it over and over, well, more power to them, because it's not for everybody, because when you lose, it's a rejection. And I think that there's nothing, absolutely nothing you could have done that would have changed the outcome of this race. You might have gotten a few more votes. But John Kennedy, despite all his warts, he is a extremely popular person in Louisiana politically. And if he had wanted to, I think he could have been governor of Louisiana. He opted not to. And I was amazed, Luke, that 6 days after he won the election, he already was saying, hey, I'm thinking about running for governor. What did you make of that?
I didn't like it. I didn't like it because he spent the last year telling everyone how he wanted to serve in the United States Senate. You win that election, the very next thing out of your mouth is, I'm thinking about running for governor. And I think it's somewhat indicative of the type of politician he is, maybe, where it's more about him and the people he serves. And I was disappointed to see that. Ultimately, I suppose that he did the right thing by remaining in the seat that he was elected to hold.
Now, if you were to talk to some political consultants, they would say you probably would be better served by becoming a Republican. Have you thought about that?
Well, look, I've never hidden from the fact that I consider myself a moderate. I've never hidden from the fact that I've voted for Republicans and Democrats, obviously. But I'm not sure there's a place for someone like me in the Republican Party. I will not stand up for the, like I mentioned, the Donald Trump MAGA wing of the party. And we've seen what politicians who stand up for against that in the Republican, what happens to them. Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, they get removed from office very quickly. And so I don't think there's a place for me in there.
But the Democratic Party also is, some would say, leaning left of the American people.
I think there is certainly a faction of the Democratic Party that is certainly to the left of where I am. And ultimately, that may have been my struggle in that as a moderate, as someone, everyone likes you a little bit, but also everyone hates you a little bit. And I've never hidden from the fact that I consider myself a John Bel Edwards Democrat. And he, I know he gets a little bit of a hard time from the far left, but...
But we're going to take a break. Luke knows the drill. He stopped on a dime. We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you as a part of our show. And if you'd like to call, talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. One of the fine gentlemen in Louisiana who is kind of a politician, Luke Mixon. He ran for office the first time, and it didn't turn out the way he wanted it to. He finished third in the U.S. Senate race with John Kennedy last year, as in a few months ago. But he is still a patriot, a guy who fought for our country in war. And he is a person who's young enough to stay around for a long, long time. And I think we'll hear from him again. And he has made it known that he would like to run for an office at some point. And he chose a big one, the U.S. Senate. It didn't work out, but he is here. And some people would run and hide and not come out of the House. I remember Floyd Patterson, one of the great fighters of all time, who I had great admiration for when he lost to Ingemar Johansson for the world title. In the early 1960s, he didn't come out of his house for months.
Well, make no mistake, there was a couple of days that I didn't want to come out of the house, but we're happy to be here.
And we're glad you are. And you fly planes. You fly for Delta Airlines, and I was on a plane. It was actually a connecting flight from Atlanta to Baton Rouge, and there's Luke Mixon sitting in the front seat. And, and Luke, you like what you do, don't you?
I do. I've flown planes my entire life. My grandfather, as I mentioned on this show before, was a World War II veteran. He was a pilot, and he kind of instilled in me both the love for aviation and also desire to join the military. And I guess I'm halfway decent at it, so I'm still figuring it out. But
how does it work? The normal pilot does what, about 10 days a month, something like that?
It depends a little bit. You know, it's very flexible, which was obviously conducive to me running for office, because you can really adjust your schedule a lot, and ultimately took a leave of absence there toward the end of the election. But yeah, you work 10 to 12 days a month, so lots of free time. It's a great job.
But you lost some money when you were running for office. I bet you're, is there such a thing as overtime? Are you pushing it? You're doing like 13, 14 days a month now?
Yeah, we're playing a little catch up right now. You asked me if I was going to D.C. Mardi Gras when I walked in, and unfortunately the answer is no. I'll be working this weekend. But yeah, we're playing a little bit of catch up right now on the finances, but no, it's all good.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Luke Mixon. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Yeah. If eventually elected to the U.S. Senate, would you be in favor of dealing with the politicalization of the U.S. Supreme Court, possibly by adding additional seats to balance the right-wingers on that court today?
I'm not... I think there needs to be a change. I think the solution, I'm open to different ideas, but probably term limits I think would be a better idea. If you add seats, and every time you have another election, you're just going to continue to add more seats, and by the time it's over, you have 25-30 Supreme Court judges. So I think term limits is probably a better idea for the Supreme Court.
That would be a great idea. In fact, it probably makes a lot more sense for Supreme Court members than it does for people in the legislature, because in the legislature, you can vote them out. But when they're on the Supreme Court, they're there for life.
Exactly. And I've heard the idea of a 16-year term limit mentioned, and I think that may be a good spot to start. But we've seen the consequences of some of these Supreme Court nominations, and it's not working out so great.
I remember when Charles Jones, the Charles D. Jones, really a nice man. He went to prison, but a good man, and we all make mistakes, but once he was asked about term limits, he says, yes, I believe in like a 32-year term limit for House members.
Yeah.
24-year limit for senators. Okay, we get it. Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on with Luke Mixon. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, so MAGA stands for Make America Great Again. Just want to emphasize that. I think this tactic of what I see is Democrats, even John Bell did it, they run as Republicans. They say they're pro-gun, they're against abortion, yet they're they call themselves Democrats. I don't get it, because that's not what the Democrat voter wants.
All right, that's not true. The Democratic Party is not monolithic in that regard. There are many pro-life Democrats, many pro-gun Democrats. As there are, believe it or not, Patrick, there are pro-choice Republicans, Patrick, and there are people in the Republican Party who are against assault weapons. But anyway, Luke Mixon, he says you're a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, God forbid you have your own ideas, right? Look, and I've spoken about guns before, and I support the Second Amendment. I support someone's right to own a gun, to hunt, to protect their home, but we've seen the crime here in Baton Rouge and throughout the state, and I mentioned on this show the changes that I think we should see, and I think we need universal background checks. I support raising the age to 21 for any type of assault-like weapon in order to purchase that, and certainly we need to increase our red flag law so we can take or temporarily remove some of these dangerous people from their weapon.
All right, Bill Huey says, why don't you run for governor as a Democrat and take on Jeff Landry? Bill Huey, now this is Bill Huey, says you could beat Jeff Landry hands down.
You know, I had the opportunity, someone I greatly admire and respect, and Governor John Bel Edwards, and I asked him once, I said, Governor Edwards, any advice? And he said, yeah, I have a piece of advice for you. He said, never go on the Jim Inkster show and announce you're running for governor without telling your wife. So I'm going to stay away from the governor talk. I take good advice from smart people. I'm going to take Governor Edwards' advice on that one and stay away from the governor talk.
All right. But Katie Bernhardt, the chair of the party, looks like she's running. You know her, and she got involved in the Senate race, and I think she was for you, but this executive committee had expressed its desire to endorse Gary Chambers, and your thoughts about Katie Bernhardt. Would she be a viable candidate?
I'm not sure. Look, so often we criticize people for putting their hat in the ring, but look, I applaud anyone who's willing to offer themselves and make the sacrifices to run for elected office. It's not easy, and so I hesitate to criticize anyone. I do think she has a bit of a conflict of interest in the fact that she is the chair of the party, and she'd have to work that out somehow. But I'll say one more thing about the ad, and it goes back to the previous questions about guns. I do think that we're seeing so much violence in our communities right now, and it's a little step, but you know, in our campaign, I believe I was the only only serious candidate that never ran an ad either on social media or TV with a gun in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that as leaders in our community, that we not glamorize the use of firearms. And that'll make a difference. It may make a small difference, but you'll never see me glamorizing the use of firearms. And I was kind of disappointed to see that in her ad.
Well, and you're from Bunkie, and you're a military veteran. You've been around firearms and probably have hunted a time or two, and probably have hunted a great deal more than John Kennedy or Gary Chambers.
There are probably very few people in the state that have fired more rounds of ammunition than I have in my life. And granted, I had a little bit of an advantage in the fact that it was firing at 4,000 rounds a minute out the front of an F-18. But look, you can support responsible gun ownership while also supporting responsible laws that they may not prevent every homicide, they may not prevent every crime, but maybe they save one or two lives, and that's what I'm all about.
Stuart downtown. Hello, Stuart. You're on the air with Luke Mixon.
Thank you, Jim, Mr. Mixon, and the audience. Good morning. Luke, congratulations to you, young man. Phenomenal performance. Endeavor. Allow me to extend the invitation to you to consider joining the registering as an independent. I think everyone should be independent. We're all taught to be independent thinkers, yet we box ourselves into these Republican, Democrat, whatever. Finally, please allow me to finish, Jim. Related to the defunding the police, intelligent law-abiding citizens, particularly people of color who have been abused by these psycho cops out here, you guys as Caucasians will never know what it's like to feel this type of disrespect and pain. And people are talking about defunding that aspect of the police. Let's get that clear.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. Your response, Luke?
Well, I believe we need qualified police officers. I think we need the resource available to hire qualified police officers to protect and serve our community. And our police are critical so that everyone can live in a safe community. Look, we all want the same thing, right? We all want a safe environment to raise our kids and our grandkids, and everyone wants that. I don't condone any police violence, particularly things we saw like with Ronald Green, but ultimately the crime in Baton Rouge and New Orleans and throughout the state, I believe some of it can be prevented by just hiring more qualified police officers.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Carol. You're on with Luke.
Yes. You talked about the Democrat Party being left of the people, but if you look at some of these measures that ended up on ballots in red states that look liberal, but they passed, from abortions to minimum wage to independent commissions drawing the congressional lines.
All right. Some would say those are just common sense measures, but I think it comes down to emphasis more so than actual policy positions. What do you emphasize? And the transgender issue, for example, it's symbolically an important issue, but to get bogged down on that as a candidate is not a good prescription for victory for a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, and I stayed away from it. Ultimately, it may have led to a little bit of my lack of attention getting, and then I stayed away from some of the hot button topics like that and tried to stay focused on the things that really affected people in Louisiana, infrastructure, jobs, the economy, and I stayed focused on that. And ultimately, maybe I paid a price for that, because sometimes talking about guns or talking about transgender rights or talking about some of those hot button political items get you a little more attention. And I don't know, maybe it's something I could have done different.
But if you had had $20 million, like our guest yesterday, Gordon McKernan, he's investing $20 million in advertising this year. You could do a lot with $20 million.
I listen to the show every day, and I listen to Ms. McKernan. Very interesting interview, and I thought about that. When he said I had $20 million for advertising, I thought, God, what would I have given for $20 million to advertise? Because ultimately, you know, I say this in politics, it's if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, does it make a noise? And if you have the best message ever, but no one hears it, It doesn't matter. And ultimately, being a first-time candidate and not having a lot of connections, we struggle with fundraising a lot and ultimately never had the resources available to get our message statewide.
Well, Eddie Rasponi did have $20 million 4 years ago and used it and ran and almost won. He lost by 40,000 votes. And I remember when he came in the studio several months later, he was commenting about that race off the air, and he says, "Can you believe how much money I spent?" I mean, he's got a lot of money, but people who have a lot of money, they got that way because they saved money. And when you $20 million goes down the drain, it's tough.
Yeah, it's funny. My grandmother passed away during the election.
And Hold that thought. Sure. Grandmother passed away during the election. We're going to pick it up with Luke Mixon. We'll hear from Johnny Palazzotto and John Word as well after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana in the home stretch with Luke Mixon, who's a young man on the rise. Even though he did not win the U.S. Senate election, he didn't get into runoff, but he made a good campaign and a good impression, and there will be a second act at some point, and of course we count on him coming on this program every now and then. Your number, if you'd like to get in under the wire, is 877-217-5757. But before we hit the break, you were telling a story. You lost your grandmother during the campaign. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And the point of my story was with respect to Mr. Spohn. Yeah, my grandmother was a really close friend of mine and someone I really looked up to. She was a lifelong Democrat, fierce advocate for social justice and equality, and it was really tough to lose her during the election. But the point of my story was that Eddie Rasponi was at her funeral. He's married to a cousin of mine, and I asked him, I don't think he would mind me saying this, but I said, any regrets about the campaign and running? And he was very clear. He's like, yeah, I regret all the money I spent on it.
He's still regretting it, and he always will, but he's a good fellow, but he was a fish out of water, and he ran his first race at 70.
Yeah, he's, I don't know him real well, but he was always very kind to me and offered me some good advice, and very nice of him to attend my grandmother's funeral.
James in Metairie. James, you're our final caller for Luke Mixon. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning to you, Jim, and to Mr. Mixon. I should say probably Commander Mixon, if I'm not mistaken.
That is right.
20-year man, Top Gun pilot, squadron commander. Proud to have you living in our state, Luke. A couple of things. I am so sick of the far right, these MAGA people, talking about how we need to abandon Ukraine. You know, Putin's forces, hundreds of thousands of troops, invaded. They're committing war crimes on a daily basis, bombing schools, hospitals, civilian apartment buildings. Your opinion of that? And one other question, please. January 6th, to me, that is an attack on our wonderful republic. Those were domestic enemies. They're being portrayed as heroes and patriots. They're not. They tried to overturn a legitimate election.
All right. Thank you, James. Luke Mixon, he gave you some red meat.
Yeah, look, I've never shied away from the January 6th thing. It was obviously my major criticism of Senator Kennedy. And, you know, that's what leadership's all about. It's about doing the right things when it's unpopular. It's about doing the right things when it's hard. And I believe he really missed an opportunity to be a patriot and to stand up for his country and to speak up against Donald Trump's lies. But as far as Ukraine is concerned, yeah, it's kind of weird, right, how the Republicans are kind of not where you'd expect them to be. And I believe Mr. Biden is going to commit, or President Biden, rather, is going to commit M1 Abrams tanks tomorrow, I believe, to Ukraine. And I support that. Look, we see them fighting a murderous tyrant, a violent dictator in the form of Vladimir Putin, and I believe we have to stand up to that.
Well, let's do this again soon and keep going.
Thanks, Mr. Mixon. I appreciate
Delta
it.
To get you there, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Luke Mixon, fine man. And we're going to be joined in a moment by Johnny Palazzotto, the promoter of music who calls Baton Rouge home, and he's logged a few decades in Los Angeles working with the likes of Kenny Loggins. But he is going to be joined by John Word, who's the number one entertainment writer in our state, and they are on deck as they are about to saunter into the studio. But before we get there, they're here to talk about the documentary of Slim Harpo, which is debuting tomorrow night at the Manship Theater, as in Thursday night. And before we get there, let's give a listen to perhaps the signature song of the remarkable Slim Harpo, who started his life in Baton Rouge as James Moore.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I can make honey, baby, let me come inside. I'm young and able to buzz all night long. I'm young and able to buzz all night long.
That is Slim Harpo, and for those who are music aficionados, he was a true legend, and I recall the story that John Fred once told me was he met the Beatles, and John Lennon wouldn't give him the time of day, and Paul McCartney was very gracious and was talking about where he was or where he came from, and he mentioned Slim Harpo, and Lennon jumped off the couch, you know Slim Harpo, and that was it. He suddenly had a new friend in the Boss Beetle, John Lennon. Johnny Palazzotto is the guy who is largely responsible for this documentary, full length, tomorrow night, Manship Theater. And this began 20 years ago, didn't it, this project?
We started getting interested in his life in 2003.
And yeah. It just took 20 years.
Yeah, well, you know, researching and digging into his life and meeting his wife and his stepson really ignited the interest from me to explore Slim Harpo. And come to find out, over 250 artists had recorded his songs. In 1964, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, and Van Morrison and them on their first albums included a Slim Harpo song. This was before Slim Harpo had his own album. He was recording singles at J.D. Miller's studio in Crowley, Louisiana.
That is remarkable. And John Wirt, who, as I announced, I think over the last generation has been the number one music and entertainment writer in our state, he's followed the career of this blues musician for a long, long time, the leading exponent of the swamp blues style. And he was one of the most commercially successful blues artists of his time, or any time.
He had a number of hits. He had four major hits, and Baby Scratch My Back in 1966 was a number one R&B song. And Raining in My Heart in 1961 was a major R&B hit, and it was in the top 40 as well. So he had two top 40 songs. That's not R&B, that's top 40. So he, the most successful blues artist from Baton Rouge, for sure.
Well, some of the people that are involved in this documentary, which did take some time to piece together, they're no longer with us. One of the principal ones, just John Wrights, is a guy, Morris' stepson, Slim Harpo's stepson, William Gambler. Great name. What happened to William Gambler?
William passed away just a couple of months ago now, November. He was very supportive of our effort. He's a feature portion of the interview, talks about driving the van, the band van, to gigs in Alabama, and just tremendous insight as to Slim and how much he loved his stepfamily and his wife and how hard his stepfather worked.
Listener notes, Raining in My Heart, Irma Thomas has done that a few times, I believe.
That's a different song.
It is. 1961.
That would be Ruler of My Heart.
Ruler of My Heart. There you go. There. Baby Scratch My Back, 1966. And I'm a King Bee, the one we heard, 1957. And that is what's the title? The original King Bee, right?
I'm a King Bee?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about for the documentary.
The original King Bee.
The original King Bee. But Slim Harpo, James Isaac Moore, he was born January 11th, 1924 in Baton Rouge. He died at 46. So next year, be 100 years. He's been dead longer than he lived. Died January 31st, 1970.
Monday. This coming Monday is the anniversary of his passing.
Of his passing, which would be 53 years since he died. But actually, I think he was born in Lobdell, Louisiana, which isn't too far away.
Correct.
But 46 years old, what got him? What was the cause of death?
Heart attack.
Heart attack.
He had a heart attack.
These guys lived pretty rough lives, didn't they?
He was, he drove a truck, hauled sugar cane, scrap iron, worked at a service station. These are all jobs that he was employed at before he committed himself to songwriting, music, performance, harmonica player, guitar player career. He was extraordinary. His father was a World War I Army private. Slim just had amazing character. I mean, he was dedicated to his family. When he got his first royalty check, he tore down the shotgun house that they were living in on 36th Street and built a brick house for his family.
Well, a listener notes he's buried in Mulatto Bend Cemetery in Port Allen.
And he was raised around there. I mean, Lobdell's just a few miles away.
Well, tomorrow night, Manship Theater, this film, this documentary, it's full length. It screens. And what's the time tomorrow night?
7:30
Manship Theater. I'm sure you'll see John Word and Johnny Palazzotto, several hundred of their closest friends. And as we know, tickets for venues like this at the Manship Theater are at a premium because there are only 325 seats. And Johnny, glad you're in the game. I see Kenny Loggins is calling it a career. You spent a lot of quality time with him back in the day, right?
We're going to see Kenny at Jazz Fest this year. And I'm really happy to be an associate of Kenny. He's one of my favorite guys.
And when you look at his body of work,
rather
substantial. It's kind of like Johnny Rivers. When you start counting the hits, it's pretty special.
You want Johnny to come back and do his final show in Baton Rouge.
That's right,
I think he is interested. We'll just have to.
Well, let's make that happen.
Yeah.
Johnny Ramostella. And thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jim.
Tomorrow night, 7:30, Manship Theater. Signature support for our program from First Financial, Tax and Accounting.